Good morning, everyone. We'll go ahead and get started. We'll open the Senate Committee on Judiciary. We have a number of bills today that are scheduled for public hearing and possible work session. I will tell you that of some of those, the work sessions will not be occurring because we need amendments based on conversations I've had with some of the individuals that are involved with those bills. We do have Representative Thatcher here. I understand, Representative Thatcher, you're here on 3204. So we're going to go ahead and open up the public hearing on 3204, let Representative Thatcher get her testimony in.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. House Bill 3204 would require reporting by a sex offender convicted or adjudicated in an Oregon court who does not actually reside in Oregon but is working or attending school in Oregon to notify within a specified time of beginning or changing school attendance or employment status. There is a pending amendment which will be discussed, I think, maybe by Representative Thatcher and maybe just by other proponents as a response to the State v. DePesh recent decision by, I believe, the Court of Appeals having to do with the establishment of venue for the crime of failure to register as a sex offender.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Kim Thatcher, State Representative from Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. This bill comes, it comes to you with 60 yes votes on the House floor, and I know that the District Attorneys Association, maybe some others, are here to talk to you about the bulk of the Dash 1 amendment, and apparently there's another amendment out there, I'm not sure, but the Dash 1 amendments I also support. But I just wanted to draw your attention to the original intent of the bill, which was just mostly on page 7, around line 21 to 26, or 7, and The original intent of the bill is to close a big gaping hole in state law concerning the registering sex offenders, because here's how the law works right now. If a person commits a sex offense in Oregon that requires them to register as a sex offender in Oregon, but then they move to, say, Vancouver, they are then required to register under Washington state law as a sex offender. But if they drive across the river back into Portland to go to college or go to work, they do not have to register as a sex offender in Oregon. This would just close that gap and require them to also register in Oregon, just like all other out-of-state sex offenders who work or go to school here. So I think the Oregon State Police have determined there's about 50 or so individuals that this law might affect. Including a predatory sex offender who works in the Portland area. And so that's what that part of the bill would do. Thank you.
All right. Any questions for the representative? Thank you very much for being here today. I'll tell you, since we got this open, we'll go ahead and continue with the testimony on this particular bill. I have Gina Skinner of IBD, and let's see, I'll just bring you two up, and I have two more. I have Caroline Wong and Sarah Clark, who also will be testifying. Is there anyone else besides those four who want to be testifying? Come on up. All right, so we'll do it in panels of two.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Gina Skinner, and I'm a Deputy District Attorney in Washington County. I have been Deputy District Attorney for 14 years, and I am here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney Association, and we are supporting House Bill 3204. And in particular, note, we are supporting the Dash 1 amendments, and I want to speak to that exclusively. As the members of this committee are aware, historically, there's been a challenge to addressing the issue of registering of sex offenders. We all most likely are in agreement that it is an important purpose of the law to have certain crimes that you are then required to register as a sex offender, and then there is a process to keep track of those sex offenders, and then the only deterrent to making sure that we can keep track of the sex offenders is that we can prosecute people that don't do it. But it puts us in this weird position where we're having to prosecute people for not doing something, and that creates a little bit of a challenge in the law. And so it has always been a little bit difficult to try to figure out how we can chase people around that are trying not to be found and trying not to register and to figure out where to prosecute them. And in every crime, venue is an element, and we have to prove the venue. Well, most recently, the State v. DePesh that came down from the Court of Appeals created an immense challenge to this problem. And in that particular decision that just came down from the Court of Appeals on April 13th, 2011, the court literally decided that, quote, that failure to register occurred literally at midnight on the 10th day after the defendant changed his residence. In short, it is at that point in time that the defendant failed, as required by the registration statute, to report his change of address. And so what the court was telling us is that we could only prosecute people when they moved. If we knew exactly where they were on the strike of midnight on the 10th day after they had moved from their last address. Well, these are people that don't want to be found, and they may not actually be at a new address, may just be hanging out at a bar, or they may be someplace else, but at that moment, in that county, that was the only place that we're now going to be allowed to prosecute those people for committing the crime of failing to register because they haven't registered their new address within 10 days. And as you can see, that's basically an impossibility. So we're stuck at a point right now where it is almost impossible for us to prosecute anybody in the state of Oregon for the crime of failure to register as a sex offender. And so the intent of this new legislation, and it is most likely not going to cost any money, there shouldn't be any additional fiscal to this, it's just a change that will put an element into the law of where they have to register, and it puts the burden on them to do that. So in essence, when they get off of supervision or they get out of custody, the place that they come out of that, they have to register there for the first time. And that is, the burden is on them to register there. Now, if they register someplace else before the 10 days, then that is an affirmative defense for them to say that, well, look, I've already registered here, and then it's fine. But if they didn't register anywhere else and they have it and we can check and say, hey, you didn't register here, that's the one place you did have to register, then we have a place and a time that we can prosecute them. Subsequently, by law, they're required to register annually within 10 days of their birthday, and they have to register within 10 days of moving, and a number of other things in the law as far as going to school and where they work and assortment of other occasions. All of those, again, have to be done at their last place of registration. So if the first place you registered was in Marion County, then you have to register at Marion County every single time for any other requirement that you have for the rest of the time you have to register, unless you change that registration by then affirmatively doing that before the 10 days expires to another location, and then that will be your default registration location going forward in time. The one difference is if you're moving from out of state into Oregon, the law will require you to register the first time in Marion County because they create one location. It's where the headquarters of the Oregon State Police is and where the headquarters of where they keep the records for the sex offender registration, and so that would be the location. The Dash 1 amendments are relatively long and they're very detailed, and Carolyn Wong from Multnomah County will be up in the next panel, and she was very involved in writing these, and she'll be able to answer any specific questions. And I note that there's one wording change that she'll be asking for. But other than that, that is the gist of what we're asking for, and it should not be any more of a burden for anybody that is going to have to register. It will make it extremely clear for everybody where that has to happen and make it possible for us to check on registrations or lack of registrations and make it so that we can prosecute people who fail to do so.
All right, Gino, hang on one second. Carolyn, why don't you go ahead and come on up, because this sounds like it's going to be a tag team. Vi, are you going to be testifying overall on the bill or this particular part on this? I just want to...
Overall.
Okay. So, Caroline, why don't you supplement whatever else you need to do with Gina? That way we can open up this part, because I think there's going to be a couple of questions. At least I want some clarification.
Yes, thank you. My name is Caroline Wong. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County. And we would support House Bill 3204 with the Dash 1 amendments. The addition that I have would be on page 3 in subsection B. I would ask for language at the end there. It says, in the county of the person's residence. I would ask that be changed to, in the county of the person's last reported residence. This would give us a firm venue, which is important that the court mentioned in State versus DePesh. The court mentioned very specifically that because the current underlying FRSO statutes do not include a fixed venue for which county has the authority to prosecute offenders, that they chose a standard of the stroke of midnight on the 10th day. So when we were deliberating on what language we would need to use in order to constitutionally satisfy the venue provision, we determined that we had to locate a fixed venue for every way a sex offender could be violating a statute. We did contemplate an easier fix, which would have been an amendment to the overall alternative venue statute. But in doing a little bit more research, there is a case, a Court of Appeals case, State versus Roper, it's an older case, that discusses how an element of a crime has to fit within the venue of a certain county for that county to take over and prosecute an offender for a crime. And so the concern is, if we simply fix venue by fixing the alternative venue statute, the problem that might arise down the line is we could face constitutional challenges when none of the elements of the FRSO actually fit into that county that's trying to prosecute the offender. So we would be in support of the Dash 1 amendments because the way the court structured their wording into DePesh, it sounds like the only way to constitutionally be on firm ground with venue is to place venue within every aspect of the failure to report statute so we know which county to prosecute the man. And I'd just like to reiterate, this is not a change as to when an offender has to register, simply where.
All right. I'm going to open up for any questions that we may have. I have a couple. I just want clarification, or at least put this on the record. So, Jenna, when you were talking, it sounded like when the person comes out and they first register, they're going to set up a default registry. Mm-hmm. Once they set that default registry, that is where they're going to continue to report unless they change their residency to another county? Or is it always falling back to the one that they...
Chair Brzezinski, that would be their default position unless they affirmatively change it to another location. They can do that at any time, and then that new location would become the default. The only thing is that they would need to make sure they did that prior to that 10 days before any other mandatory registration period. They couldn't wait and then do it after the fact. But if they had that default and then within 6 months and it didn't fall within their birthday, they wanted to move to another location, they would just move to another location. That would go, all those records go immediately to the Oregon State Police headquarters in Salem, and they keep a mass location of all those. They would note that was now their default, and then that would remain their default location until another move, if ever, was done by the defendant.
Okay, and then so their obligation would be upon moving, as they do it appropriately in the time frame and all like that, they have 10 days from the time they move to get that new registry entered into the system.
Chair Brzezinski, that's correct. They are always obligated to go back to register to their last known registration unless they do it at a new place prior to the time that they would have had to meet the deadline to do it at the old location.
Okay. And then let's see, the other thing is, since we did not have, quote unquote, control, I guess, of the Dash ones being done, and hearing Caroline's statement as to having an alternative, did we get any heads up from our legal counsel as to what they thought was more appropriate, a way to handle this?
So. Well, we know that House Bill 3126, which you're going to be listening to testimony on, is actually an amendment to the alternative venue provision, and it seeks to change the alternative venue specific to fail to register cases. And although that's a great fallback alternative, we had concerns in reviewing the case law that that would not necessarily be constitutionally solid. And I do believe that we would face legal challenges to the alternative venue statute, which is why we then took this route with the Dash 1 amendments.
Okay, and counsel here has told me that between the two that they may kind of end up getting merged. So am I hearing that of the choices that we have before us, the 3204 would be the preferred and not moving forward on the 3126, or do you think we need them both?
Chair Brzezinski, I think our position actually would be we prefer that we move them both. They are not necessarily exclusive of each other. The 3126, in essence, would get merged into 3204 if it gets passed in its entirety. It could 3126 could be a quick fix if 3204 doesn't make it out. 3126 was what we had contemplated prior to the Depeche decision coming out, and then once that came out, it made the problem more glaring, and that's why more time was put into creating a more substantial fix to the actual substantive statute itself. So I think that we would actually ask the committee move on both bills.
Okay, that's fine. What we'll probably want to do, though, is hold this one as well as the other one. Just I want council to work with our legislative council, make sure we have everything T's and I's dotted, because if we need any type of conforming amendments or whatever, if that's necessary, we'll get it done and not have to worry about it getting held up somewhere else. All right, any other questions for the two? Thank you all very much. And Vi, why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony? And if you wouldn't mind stepping back, I'm going to go ahead and ask Sarah Clark to please come forward.
For the record, Vi Beatty, manager of the Oregon State Police Sex Offender Registry. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Originally, 3204 was to fix the hole in statute that Representative Thatcher brought forward. And we had discussed that with her because we do have about 50 persons, one who is a predatory sex offender residing in Washington, working or attending school in Oregon, who are currently not required to register. When the Dash 1 amendments came forward, what I supplied you is hopefully an easier way to read the fixes. So it talks about what current registration requirements are, that there are no change, but there are reporting requirement differences. So you can go down piece by piece and you can look at if the person is releasing from a facility. My understanding, and the attorneys can correct me if I'm wrong, my understanding is, in plain language, if someone is releasing from a facility, they register either in the county where they release from or where they're put onto supervision in, or they can register in the county they reside in if they do so within 10 days. So what this does is just kind of brings it down into an easier form to understand. I'm available for any questions if you have any.
Okay, great. Sarah, why don't you give us your testimony?
Good morning. I'm Officer Sarah Clark with the Portland Police Bureau Sex Offender Registration Detail. We're currently operating our three-person detail with a $500,000 federal grant under the COPS Child Sexual Predator Program. How the Depeche case has been affecting us in the past since the decision was made is we really haven't been able to prosecute anybody in Multnomah County. We haven't been able to arrest anybody with good conscience. We have officers still doing it because of the way that the law is written. They're still arresting them, but they're just getting released the next day because there's not grounds for us to keep them. Unfortunately, with the way that sex offenders work, we're not finding them on that 10th day. We're finding them, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 months out of compliance. And trying to ask a sex offender or pretty much anybody that's in the criminal element, where were you at midnight on such and such a day? They can't remember where they were last week, let alone 3 months ago, 10 days after their birthday, or 10 days after they moved. Along with that, the people that they reside with usually aren't willing to come and testify against the person that they live with. Girlfriends, wives, children aren't going to testify against their family members as to where they were living or residing on that day. And within the Tri-County area, if these sex offenders are working or going to school and they live in Multnomah County but work in Clackamas County and they were at work on that 10th day at midnight, now we're falling into jurisdictional issues again. So it's made it very difficult for us to manage and track our 3,600 sex offenders that we have in Multnomah County. So, thank you.
All right, great. Thank you. Any questions for either one on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3204, and it's my understanding, based on the testimony we heard today, we at least need to make a modification to the Dash 1s to clean up the one language change on page 3. Looks like on lines 14 and 15, We'll also work with our council to make certain that we have all the I's dotted and T's crossed as it pertains to this one and 3126. Now I'm looking to see who else we have on what. Kind of a hodgepodge. I think what we're going to do is just go from the top and work through the docket at this point. And so I apologize. I know there's a few people here. Let me do this. Gina, I'm going to go ahead and let you come up and testify. We'll go ahead. Let's do the 3126 since it parallels to this. So we'll open the public hearing for 3126 and give us the overview.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, as you've already heard, House Bill 3126 would modify the general rules of venue for criminal prosecution, specifically targeting the failure to report as a sex offender. This, again, is oriented more towards venue and less for the substantive statute itself. Holds that if you cannot readily determine the county in which the commission of the crime of failure to register takes place, the trial venue may be established in the county in which the defendant last reported as a sex offender or the county in which the defendant is apprehended.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Gina Skinner, and I am a member of the Oregon District Attorney Association, District Attorney in Washington County, Oregon, and here to support House Bill 3126. In essence, already testified regarding this, but specifically the distinguishing factor is that the last bill, 3204, substantially amends the actual statute of failure to register a sex offender. This House Bill 3126 adds a provision to the venue statute, which applies to all cases. And so every crime has to have a venue or a location where that crime was committed in a way that it can be determined. But you can imagine a situation where you have a boyfriend beating up a girlfriend and they're driving up I-5 for 45 minutes, you could run through five different counties. Well, who is supposed to prosecute that case? And that's the essence of what these statutes are for, is to try to figure that out. And so all this is doing is creating a default so that if it's not readily apparent that based on whether it's the current law or hopefully the amendments done in 3204, that it should be prosecuted in this county because of the actual statute itself, this venue subsection will create a default that at the last resort, if it can't be figured out, then it can be done either where they last registered or where the person was arrested. Because one of the last comment is one of the problems with these cases is we often have people that have been on abscond status for years, literally, and we don't know where they've been. They could have been out of state. They could have been out of country. They have been gone. And so trying to establish where they last registered. Another thing I'm just thinking of is that if we do change the law of 3204, you may have people that it may take years to capture them into that law over time as we are registering people that are coming into the system. And so this will create a default that will capture those cases where currently we are unable to prosecute because we can't set a place for that prosecution to occur, even though they have not registered for some period of time and they're out of compliance.
All right, great. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you for coming
Thank
forward.
You.
Is there anyone else who wanted to testify today on House Bill 3126? Not seeing, we're going to close the public hearing. What we'll do is at the end of today, we'll go through all the bills, and we have an obligation to put on the record where they're going to be next scheduled, since we're now into the time frame that if we don't note those things, that means they can't move forward. But we'll get that done once we get through this process. So I'll close the public hearing on 3126. We're going to go to the top of the agenda and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2103.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2103A pertains to individuals who are currently undergoing a diversion program pursuant to a conviction for DUI. Those individuals are obligated to undergo an alcohol and drug treatment assessment and sometimes treatment as ordered. 2103A would allow these individuals to draw upon state medical assistance programs to pay for the costs of the assessment and treatment.
All right, Carolyn. Karen Wheeler here to testify. Karen, come on up. Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 2103?
Good Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addiction Programs Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. With the Oregon Health Authority, I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2103. Roughly 1,500 DUI offenders who access addiction treatment in 2010 were able to access their health plan benefits to pay for treatment. And that's out of a total of about 17,000 DUI offenders who accessed treatment. House Bill 2103 clarifies for the managed care plans and the state medical assistance program and plan administrators who manage that program that people who are convicted of DUI or who are under a diversion agreement may utilize their medical benefits to pay for medically necessary addiction services. So this would cover people that are that have a diagnosis of an illness and who have the state medical plan, who are eligible for the state medical plan. Currently, the statute does not include permissive language related to the use of the state medical program. This bill seeks to just add the permissive language, but does not mandate coverage. Since the statutes do not refer to this program currently, they do refer to the Intoxicated Driver Program Fund. They also refer to individuals paying for their own treatment. So this has led some managed care companies to believe that this is not a covered benefit because it's a court-mandated or court-referred service. The statutes did not anticipate the Oregon Health Plan when they were developed in, it was either the late 1970s or the early 1980s. So basically this bill is, to us, a technical clarification bill. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Cruz first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. just for the record, because it talks about third-party resources, we're talking specifically about the health plan, not about other third-party, correct?
Chair Prasansky, Senator Cruz, yes, that is correct. Only the state medical program.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Wheeler, we talked in our office about whether this would apply only to those who are currently enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan or it would give them access to the Oregon Health Plan. I see from your written statement here that you were planning an amendment to clarify that it's only for those who are currently enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan.
Chair Prasansky, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct. There's an amendment in the works that would make it very clear that this is only for people who are enrolled and eligible for the Medicaid program.
All right. Any other questions or comments? All right. I just want to clarify the numbers you gave us at the very beginning, Karen. You said 1,500 have been able to access out of 17,000. What the 1,500 represented who? What population?
Chair Prasansky, the 1,500 represents those who were on the Oregon Health Plan,
okay,
and who were able to access their benefit,
okay,
when they went to treatment.
And the 17,000 was the total number of people that had been referred either through conviction or through diversion?
Chair Prasansky, that's correct. That's right. The total population of DUI offenders.
Great. Thank you very much. Any other comments? Thank you very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2103, and we'll go ahead and open up our next public hearing on House Bill 2174A.
Chair Prasansky, members of the committee, House Bill 2174A makes a variety of changes to different aspects of our drug laws. First of all, it modifies the term, the purposes for which the Illegal Drug Cleanup Fund may be used. Essentially, it expands for training, cleanup funding. Secondly, it makes modification to the conditional discharge statute. Conditional discharge statute is a statute commonly affiliated with drug courts. Basically, if you do certain things, it can lead to a dismissal. And certain crimes are already included. This adds endangering the welfare of a minor and frequenting a place where controlled substances are used as crimes that could theoretically be applicable under this section. It makes some organizational changes, breaking out the way certain crimes are handled within the statutory framework. This doesn't raise or lower penalties. It just sets them out to make it sort of easier to track. It breaks out both Schedule 5 controlled substances as separate from Schedules 3 and 4, and it breaks out oxycodone, hydrocodone, and methadone into their own separate statutes. Finally, it repeals a law that currently prohibits the Oregon Board of Pharmacy from scheduling an FDA-approved over-the-counter drug as a controlled substance for their own purposes.
All right, Rob, before you start, is there going to be anyone else who will want to testify today on 2174? All right, Rob, go ahead.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, District Attorney from Lincoln County, here wearing my hat today as legal advisor for the Oregon Narcotics Enforcement Association. House Bill 2174A, as aptly summarized by counsel, is a technical improvements bill to our drug statutes. It comes to you unanimously, having passed the House Health Care Committee, unanimously passed the House Judiciary Committee, and unanimously passed the House 59-0. On the back side of my testimony, I actually provide a very brief section-by-section summary of what this bill does, and counsel actually pretty succinctly summarized it. I'll just go through this real quickly. I won't read this to you, but Section 1 basically deals with an issue that cropped up about 3 months ago. The feds have run out of money to clean up meth labs. The good news for us is that we have very few meth lab incidents. We've had one so far this year. But we need to tweak our statutes to enable us to fully utilize a special small fund we've been storing up with DEQ so we can keep our guys trained to respond and deal with meth lab incidents. Section 2 is an amendment to our conditional discharge CD statute as summarized by counsel. Back in 2005 in our omnibus meth legislation, we expanded the use of conditional discharges from drug crimes to theft crimes that are driven by addiction. Approximately 78% of the property crimes committed in the state of Oregon are driven by addicts stealing to pay for addiction, so it's an appropriate use of conditional discharge. Section 2 would expand that to drug endangering the welfare of a minor and frequenting a place where controlled substances are used, so we can use that CD statute to really offer a big carrot for folks to get clean. Section 3 clarifies a very technical issue in our prescription statutes. We need to break out Schedule 5 from Schedules 3 and 4 in the way we read our statute, because some Schedule 5 controlled substances are prescription, others are not, and we just need to clarify it. So it's a very technical issue I can get into further if you'd like, but it was pointed out to me by the National Alliance for Model State Drug Laws. It's just an imprecision in our statute. Section 4 repeals an antiquated statute that basically prohibits our pharmacy board from doing their job. Occasionally, we run into an OTC drug that is dangerous, as we have run into over the past few decades. PPA is one that comes to mind, phenylpropanolamine. About 10 years ago, it was killing young women and kids, and we needed to remove it from the market. We were constrained here in the state of Oregon to do that because we had this antiquated statute on the books, and it took the feds quite a while to actually do the right thing, and they did the right thing eventually. It took them a couple of years, and so Section 4 proposes to get rid of that statute, which really serves no function at all and just hampers our pharmacy board's ability to do their job. Sections 5 through 20, the last thing this bill does, is simply breaks out hydrocodone, oxycodone, and methadone into their own statutes. It doesn't increase, lower, or change any of the penalties or classifications of any of those crimes. The reason we want to do that is on the front side of my testimony, you can see we've been facing some drug trends here in the state of Oregon, and actually nationally, this is reflective of the national trends, where we've seen prescription drug abuse on an ever-increasing rate, and all of our data basically is reflecting that, whether we look at it. I've provided you treatment admissions here, but if you look at arrest data, whatever you want to look at, prescription drug abuse is something we want to get a better handle on. And so the 1, 2, 3 in that order are hydrocodone, oxycodone, and methadone in terms of the top three abused prescription drugs. We want to get a handle on the data. In 2005, we broke out heroin, methamphetamine, ecstasy, a variety of other drugs into separate statutes so we can track data. We want to do the same for prescription drug abuse so we can hopefully in future sessions bring some thoughtful policy decisions for you to make. But first, we've got to collect the data. So that's pretty much what House Bill 2174A does. Would encourage you to move it to the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Happy to answer any questions.
Great, thanks. Questions? All right, Senator Cruz.
There's suggested amendments to this as well, having to do with PMP, which you're incredibly familiar with. Any comments on any of that at this point in time? Because we haven't talked about it.
Yeah, Chair Pruszynski and Senator Cruz, there was quite a bit of discussion about amendments to House Bill 2174A to use it as a vehicle to accomplish a number of things. One was a global policy change relating to possession of controlled substance with the effort to reduce some or reduce some expenses, save some money. Another was a technical fix to our prescription monitoring program in terms of the notice that's given to dispensing each prescription. I certainly have a position and some things I'd like to accomplish on both of those, but this is not the vehicle, it's not the right time, and so I think those discussions will continue. Those may come back before you in another bill at another time, or may not. This is something we may need to deal with in the interim. I'm not real sure at this time. So, so far as I can tell, none of those proposed amendments are essentially ripe.
All right. Any other questions or comments? With that, let me make a comment on there are two proposals at work being considered for 2174. The one dealing with notification on prescription drugs. I've met with proponents and opponents on that. They are going to continue to meet. This bill is going to, let's say, it will be moving forward at some point, but we're not going to move it out today because this may actually need to be the vehicle for some work. So at this point, we will be scheduling this for a follow-up work session to allow the interested parties on those amendments. Plus, there's another budget issue that we're dealing with in the public safety, and this may actually need to be one of the vehicles for that as well. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2174A, and we'll move into the next one, which will be House Bill 3186A.
Chair Pruszynski, members of the committee, House Bill 3186A deals with the currently existing employment exception to the general prohibition against using a mobile communication device while driving. This would generally eliminate that exception and instead replace it with a number of narrower exceptions. Including individuals operating a tow or roadside assistance vehicle or operating a vehicle owned or contracted by a utility for the purpose of maintaining that utility. The largest effect, however, is to eliminate the plenary exception for somebody driving, talking on their phone, and claiming that it pertains to employment.
All right. I have four people that are signed up at this point, so I'm going to go ahead and call up two panels. Al Elkins and Mike Wagner, why don't you all come forward?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Tow Truck Association. With me today is Mike Wagner, Chairman of the Board of the Oregon Tow Truck Association. We are here in support of House Bill 3186A. This bill would allow us to continue to use cell phones while operating a tow vehicle or roadside assistance vehicle while acting in the scope of our employment. Tow drivers need to use all manners of communication, such as cell phones and two-way radios, to perform their jobs safely. When we are in locations where cell phone devices do not work, then we need to be able to use two-way radios, such as CB radios, walkie-talkies, or Nextel phones. We need to be able to communicate with and from our trucks to the yard and to flaggers and sometimes even law enforcement officers. Our industry needs to be able to have all different types of communication devices available to perform a job safely and to the best of our ability. That is why we support this bill. That concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mike, do you have anything to add?
I just am hopeful that we can continue to have all the resources available to us to do our job that we need. And cell phones are part of the puzzle.
I do need you to put your name on the record.
I'm sorry, Mike Wagner with the Oregon Tow Truck Association, Centium Towing.
All right, thank you very much. Questions for either gentleman? Thank you all for coming
thank
forward.
Thank you.
I have two other people that want to give testimony, Dr. Katrina Nedberg and Kevin Campbell. Is there anyone else who will want to testify on this bill, 3186? Kevin, you want to go ahead and start off?
You betcha. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, here to speak in favor of House Bill 3186A. In particular, just want to comment regarding Section 1, Sub 3G. That is the main adjustment to the law that's being proposed by this bill. Our police chief from Gearhart, Jeff Bowman, has been very active in trying to get this change. He's worked on behalf of our association. He's a police chief who, of course, is on the road all the time, issuing citations and making sure his community is safe. It's become more and more apparent to people over the last several months that there are actual police chiefs that are on the road working all the time. Unfortunately, the recent shooting of Chief Painter in Rainier is an example, and then the responding officer to that incident, Chief Marvin Hoover from Klaskanai, all police chiefs on the road working. This particular amendment, as you know, has been treated differently by judges throughout the state. As a result, officers issuing these citations do not have the same expectation for a result in court. It's ended up being a confusion, of course. I think the legislature was clear in what the legislature was trying to communicate in terms of what a work-related exception was. But in reality, the public began to use work-related as a catchphrase when they were pulled over for this citation, raising the specter of work-related then for an officer where a judge may accept that meant that the ticket may be dismissed. It also increased the number of contested citations, and that just increases the cost to the system. And so the advantage of the removal of this broad work-related exception is that it creates a brighter line and more clarity for both for the public, for officers, and for judges who have to make disposition regarding these citations. And so with that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we support this clarification. We believe that it's always difficult to educate the public regarding these things, especially when it's confusing. We believe that removal of this particular exemption will increase our chances that we can communicate to the public the importance of operating their motor vehicles without the use of their mobile communication devices. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg, and I'm the state epidemiologist and administrator for the Office of Disease Prevention and Epidemiology within the Oregon Health Authority. And I'm also here in support of removing this particular exemption. From a public health standpoint, motor vehicle crashes are the leading cause of death among Oregonians ages 1 to 44. Each year, around 450 Oregonians are killed in crashes, and over 2,200 people are hospitalized for a total of hospitalization charges exceeding $88 million. So it costs a lot of money. Distracted driving is one of the primary factors that leads to motor vehicle crashes. And for that reason, we also support enacting this particular bill because it really limits the exemptions to this. We understand that there are people who need to operate or use mobile communication devices in the scope of their employment, but the fewer exemptions we have to the particular law, the better off we are from a public health standpoint. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right, questions? Looks like there's none. Thank you very much for coming forward.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd also like to put AAA on record as supporting this bill as well. Craig was unable to be here, Craig Campbell, and so he asked me to do that. So,
all right. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
So the other thing I'm going to say is that there is going to be an amendment to this bill. I've spoken to the other co-chief sponsor, Representative Berger, and she's in agreement. Basically, what it's going to do, if you have the bill, I don't have it in front of me, but there's a section that allows for individuals as volunteers to perform emergency services or public safety services. We're going to take it off for volunteers, so people that are actually engaged in business, such as a someone working maintenance for public works that are out in a snowstorm that needs to communicate as to where they need to move to plow roads and stuff like that. I know some of the municipalities have contact through cell phones because they're bringing in operation of equipment that does not have all the markings of an emergency service vehicle, and so we're going to add that, and then it will be coming back. Any other comments, Senator Bonamici?
It looks like the language about activating or deactivating a mobile communication device or function of the device is just moved to a different section, but I wonder if we could get just some clarification on the record about what that means.
Okay.
It's in lines 15
yep.
and 16.
I know that. I mean, my assumption was it's basically turning it on and turning it off, but I don't know if there's been any other discussion on the House side. And Kevin, since you probably have tracked this on the other side, was there any other testimony?
Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee, I believe it is simply that. It's activating or deactivating the device, turning it on or turning it off.
That's it.
Yes. I believe it's designed to be very limited.
Right. All right. So we may want to have a little more discussion on that before the bill comes back.
Great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right, with that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3186A and open up our last of our public hearings on 3239.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3239 again pertains to sex offenders. As you know from previous testimony and generally, sex offenders in Oregon are subject to a variety of reporting requirements, and there are a range of crimes that give rise to this registry requirement. House Bill 3239 would add the crime of sexual assault of an animal to the list of those that would require registry as a sex offender.
Okay, so I'm going to go ahead and ask Dinah, why don't you come up, and Alan, and Vi, why don't you three come up at this point, because it looks like you three are going to either be in support or neutral on it. Dinah, if you want to get started, that would be great.
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Dinah Vitolins, and I am the District Attorney of Cook County, and I'm here to speak to you to ask you to support House Bill 3239, the -1 amendments. We do not object to that. Would be the Oregon District Attorneys Association. However, the association does object to the -2 amendments, which would exempt juveniles from the requirement to register as sex offenders if they're adjudicated as committing a sexual assault against an animal. Heidi Moad sent me a case that I'd like to talk to you a little bit about. The cases that involve sexual assaults of animals are really gruesome. She told me that and sent me the information about an individual who had sexually abused his pit bull for about 7 to 9 years, starting as a juvenile and then continuing as an adult. When the individual was interviewed by police officers and asked how the dog felt, he said he thought the dog consented because the dog didn't try to run away, which is really disturbing, in my opinion, after having that kind of activity with a dog. We had a case in Crook County where an individual would poach deer and then engage in sexual acts with the carcass of the deer. When he was interviewed, he also said it really didn't matter because the deer was dead. Those are the kind of individuals who we want to keep track of, and that's the purpose, as Ms. Skinner earlier said, of the sex offender registration statute. Studies have shown that bestiality there is a potential link for crossover into violence against human beings, specifically infants and children, because human-animal sexual relations always involve coercion. They often cause pain to animals and even death, and animals are unable to consent. Ms. Moad also let me know that she spoke with members of Intercept, who's the Computer Child Pornography Task Force in Oregon. They looked at the top 30 child porn downloaders across the state and said that 13 of the 30 had at least 10 bestiality images, videos downloaded as well. For that reason, I ask that you support House Bill 3239 and the -1 amendments.
All right. Thank you. Al?
My name is Alan Zog. I'm currently an investigator with the Oregon Humane Society, commissioned by the governor to investigate animal cruelty laws. I have 28 years of law enforcement experience in the state of Oregon. Most recently, I retired from the Hillsborough Police Department as a commander. I'm here in support of House Bill 3239 because of the link between animal abuse and child abuse, and that these perpetrators of the crimes need to be tracked and registered because they pick on victims, as I said, that cannot defend themselves or speak out and report these crimes. Most of the animal abuse people are discovered when other crimes are being investigated against them, and that's how they are discovered and prosecuted. And we feel that it is important that these people be registered and tracked. So again, I urge the support for this bill.
All right, thank you. Vi?
For the record, Vi Beatty, manager of the Oregon State Sex Offender Registry with Oregon State Police, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Adding sexual assault of an animal has a very minimal fiscal impact to the registry and its partner agencies. Currently, a check of CJIS, the Criminal Justice Information System, shows that there are about 110 persons for the convicted for the entire chapter. We don't have juvenile numbers, but we do have adult. Of that, we're anticipating that there are maybe a handful that fall under sexual assault of an animal. So the only question on this particular bill is the fact that the language at the end says persons convicted before, on, or after the effective date of this bill. And I'm talking about the originals. I haven't seen the amendments yet. Where all of our other statutes where we added crimes since 1999 for registration stated on or after the effective date. So I just have a question about that particular piece. I'm available for any questions.
So just to let you know, what we're talking about is there's been a lot of discussion about amendments. My understanding, there were some amendments that were considered on the House side, but none of those amendments were actually adopted because we're still got the original bill before us. And we do not actually have anything in the way of amendments in front of this committee. And I just want to confirm that at this point. All right, so we're just acknowledging for the record, yes, there is something that was on the House chamber or within the House chamber that were considered, but as far as I know, nothing has been advanced to our side for us to consider them at this point.
Okay.
So, questions for anyone on this panel? Senator Whitsett first.
A question to the council regarding the before, sexual assault on animal before, on or after the effective date before, which obviously is retroactive. What effect would that have? I mean, first of all, is it legal to change the reporting requirement, which is a penalty after the fact, after someone has been adjudicated? Would that be legal to do? And secondly, how many people are we talking about?
Chair Przanski, Senator Whitsett, as to the second part, I can tell you I have no idea how many people we're talking about. I have no factual information about the number of people who have been convicted. Maybe one of the proponents would be able to help out with that. As for the first part of your question, that was the subject of what was in the House, the Dash 1 amendments. It was basically that exact concern. Does this create a sort of de facto resentencing where you're adding an additional component to an already existing sentence and in that way sort of cheating? Resentencing someone without the formality of an actual resentencing. That issue was vetted among the proponents at the time. There were discussions with legislative counsel. What I can tell you, not having been privy to all of those, is that it was ultimately resolved to their satisfaction that it would not create a legal question. Whether it might create a practical question in terms of the delivery of the notice of that requirement to each individual is separate, but in terms of legality, the proponents were ultimately satisfied that it is something that they could do after conversation with legislative council.
Thank you.
I want to follow up on that. So if we were going to go, quote unquote, back in time to give notice, how far back would we be going? How far back as to a conviction? Are we talking perpetuity? Or are we talking a set number of years?
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, it doesn't
It would just be in perpetuity. And if I could quickly answer that ex post facto issue, the court answered that question directly on point in State versus McNabb 334 Oregon 469, where they were where an individual who was not required to register as a sex offender was later at the time he was convicted was later prosecuted for failure to register as a sex offender, raised that issue as a defense, and the Supreme Court held that the Oregon law requiring registration of sex offenders is a civil, not a criminal penalty designed to prevent future sex offenses, so there was no ex post facto issue.
Thank you for putting that on the record. That's exactly what I had remembered from those line of cases. So what we're going to do here, we've got one other person that wants to testify. I'm going to see if anyone else wants to. I will tell you that based on what I've heard and what we now have on the record, I expect there will be an amendment. I do not feel comfortable to try to go back in time into perpetuity. So with that, if there's not any other questions for anyone on this panel, thank you all very much for coming forward. And I have Gail Meyer, who also wants to testify on this one. And does anyone else want to testify on 3239?
Thank you, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. What I would like the committee to understand is that this would be the very first time that you would expand the use of the sex offender registry beyond its original purpose. Its original purpose was to track persons who were known to be a sexual hazard to children and other adults. And so this would be the first effort to expand this now beyond that original purpose. There, we have not heard from treatment providers here saying that there's a link between those who offend against animals and those who offend against persons. We haven't heard from the treatment providers, and we haven't heard from the supervision community about that. I did, over on the House side, ask them, the supervision community, is there anything in writing, any studies you can show me? And I read about four or five studies on bestiality, and I can say that the studies were bland as to any conclusion that could be reached as to whether or not someone who offends against an animal will necessarily predictively poses a risk of offending against a child or a human. There's a correspondingly reverse indicator. If a juvenile offends against an animal, it's a good indicator that juvenile has been the victim of sexual assault him or herself. But it is not a good predictor that that juvenile will necessarily offend against another child or as an adult against an adult. So this would be the very first time that you're expanding the use, the obligation to register beyond its original purpose. And I just read a New York Times article the other day. Someone sent it to me. There's a burgeoning interest in more and more registries all across the United States. Some want to register DUI offenders. Some want to register first degree murderers, arsonists, all of that. And I guess the real question is, what's the purpose of Oregon's sex offender registry? And this is the first time you're going afield of that. With respect to the amendments, again, this does apply to juveniles. And anytime anyone needs to register, there is the potential that that information will be released to the public. I know that this bill doesn't deal with releasing the information to the general public, but there are provisions in our registry law where the general public can access this information. So if you have juveniles engaging in assaults against animals and they have to register, that information can be disclosed to the general public under certain circumstances. As to the retroactivity piece, I do think it's a problem. Definitely in terms of prosecution, it would be a problem. You have to show that these people had notice of the obligation to register. That's generally done at the time of sentencing, and you'd have to somehow logistically go back. But I do ask the committee to use caution in going beyond this. You haven't heard from the treatment community. You haven't heard from the supervision community that this is absolutely necessary. I'd be happy to share some of the studies that I've read if anyone's interested. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Were you aware that veterinarians are required to report animal abuse of any kind precisely because of its alleged precursor activity to human abuse. To my knowledge, I haven't seen a study that links sexual abuse specifically in animals to subsequent sexual abuse in humans. But I think there's little doubt that there is those people who are likely to, those people who have abused animals are much more likely to subsequently abuse humans.
Chair Brzezinski, Senator Whitsitt, thank you. I was not aware of that obligation on veterinarians, but I can imagine it's true. The studies that I read said that those who offend against animals, it's an indicator of generalized assaultive aggressive behavior. There's a good link in that respect as to necessarily making the conclusive link that it leads to further sexual conduct. The studies that I read suggested that there's not been an established scientific link, and maybe there's countervailing studies, but the ones that were forwarded to me by the supervision community said otherwise. But I'd be happy to share whatever I have.
All right, any other questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3239, and we're going to go ahead and open up our work session that we have scheduled for today on 3041.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 3041 would authorize a district attorney to file a petition during a criminal case involving the abuse of animals to seek the forfeiture of that animal. Under current law, only the county animal service provider is able to file for forfeiture.
All right, and I believe that we kind of left the record open to allow Dinah to come over to give testimony, so why don't you go ahead and come on up.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Dinah Vitalins, and I'm Crook County District Attorney. I asked Representative Olson to sponsor House Bill 3041 when I became involved in a significant animal abuse case and realized that although I was handling the prosecution, I couldn't also handle the forfeiture, even though I was most familiar with the facts of the case. Briefly, to tell you a little bit about the case, you should be getting an exhibit I've marked as 1 and 2. This involved individuals from out of state, from California, who decided that they were going to do an investment scheme with thoroughbred racehorses. They were first involved in California, and the first exhibit are two of the horses that were seized in a California case. They moved their horses from California to Oregon and then bought a ranch in Powell Butte. And the idea was that they would sell the idea to investors, mostly doctors and lawyers, that here's this investment opportunity with great tax benefits. So they moved 60 horses onto a beautiful ranch in Powell Butte, Oregon. In December of 2008, the Crook County Sheriff's Office received many, many complaints from individuals who were passing by the ranch, which is located on Highway 126 in Crook County, that the horses were malnourished and didn't look good. In December of 2008, the Sheriff's Office made contact with the caretakers and the owners and said, look, you need to feed your horses more. We continue to monitor the situation, which is our policy and practice in Crook County. We always work with individuals when we get animal abuse or animal neglect complaints to try to support them in terms of getting heaters for water so that water doesn't freeze over, to get extra feed, whatever we can do prior to taking any kind of legal action. Nothing got better. In fact, it got worse. On March 28, 2009, we obtained a search warrant and executed that search warrant and seized 13 of the 60 horses. Those 13 were seized at the request of the veterinarian who accompanied the sheriff's deputies, and the Exhibit 2 are a few of the horses that were seized. We then filed a petition to forfeit the horses. There was a 4-day hearing involving that where testimony was submitted by both sides. At the end of that testimony, the court found that we had established probable cause to forfeit all the 13 horses. The owners of the horses were required to post a bond in the amount of $50,000. They did not do that. We were able to demonstrate that we paid $34,938.72 in veterinary bills and feed, and that it would continue to cost us $31.50 a day to feed the horses until the criminal cases were resolved. The court ordered a $50,000 bond, which the owners of the horses did not post, and so the animals were forfeited. Everybody involved in the case was later convicted of animal neglect based on the condition of the horses that were there. So I briefly listened to the testimony that was presented last week that was opposed to, or that was in support of the Dash 1 amendments, and I can tell you that we do not seize animals as a profit motive. It is completely expensive to try to seize animals and care for them. As you can tell, $31.50 a day for feed alone, that does not even begin to address where we house the animals and how much we have to pay for veterinary bills. And so I'd ask that you support House Bill 3041 and do not support the Dash 1 amendments.
All right, thank you. Questions? All right, thank you very much. Since we did leave the record somewhat open, was there anyone else here that wanted to say anything before I close this part of the work session? All right, I'll go ahead and let's see. Someone officially closed, taking any additional testimony during the work session. We're still in work session on House Bill 3041, and the chair is willing to entertain a motion. We have all the paperwork for it. And
I'm assuming you don't like the ones.
I do not.
I kind of do.
Okay. If you want to move them, you can move them. Or if you want
to. Well, it's a few of those exercises.
Okay. Senator Bonamici, would you provide us with a motion on the 3041?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3041 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Bonamici moves House Bill 3041 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Wissett first.
Thank you, Mr. Brzezinski. I indicated I had some concern about the constitutionality of the current law. I got a report from Josh Nasby, and he assures me that it is constitutional in that you can have parallel criminal and civil forfeiture actions going on at the same time. My objection to this bill at this time, I still have some problems with that, but then it's, you know, it's been that way for 300 years. Probably my objection isn't too relevant. But I do have a problem with the individual, the district attorney, who brings charges of animal abuse, also bringing a petition to forfeit the animals. I think it very likely could give some district attorneys a very strong plea bargaining position, which might not be appropriate.
Other questions? Comments? We have a motion before us, and anyone objecting to the motion of moving the bill to the floor with the due pass recommendation? I have Senator Wissett, Senator Cruz objecting, with the other three of us supporting. The motion carries, and the chair will be the carrier on House Bill 3041 to the floor, and we'll close that work session. Now, thanks to everyone for this. Now we're going to go back up to the bills that we had under the public hearing, and what we're going to do is figure out where we're moving them at this point. So we. All right. This is what we're going to do. I agree with the council's suggestion. Every bill that we have set for public hearing, we've now had public hearings, so we're going to carry the bill forward for the work session only, and that's going to be House Bill 2103A, House Bill 2174A, House Bill 3126, House Bill 3186A, House Bill 3204, and House Bill 3239. All of those bills, which count up to six, will be moved and scheduled for next Tuesday, May 31st. All right, so the six bills we had that were scheduled for public hearing and possible work session, all six of those are moving forward for work session only next Tuesday, a week from today, which is May 31st. And you'll need to wait to see the time. It's either going to start at 8 o'clock or it will be 8:30, but it will be in the morning. Yeah. And as council has stressed, if you have any amendments that you want to be considered for this, any of these bills, he has to have the language, proposed language, by the end of today. That's 5 p.m. today, because we are now at a critical stage where we're not going to be able to get as much out of legislative council as we might want, just because everyone's going to be pushing legislative council. On top of that, we have to then get all of the amendments ran through fiscal and getting fiscal and revenues. And so if you have any amendments, please provide them to Aaron by the end of today. Or let's just put it this way, they come in later than today, and even at, we're not even sure if we can make the deadlines today. We think we can, but the longer you wait, the less likely any amendments will be made, and it could actually jeopardize the bill in its entirety. All right, with that, ladies, is there anything we need to cover, Pam?
Tomorrow.
Yeah, all right, so tomorrow is one of our earlier starts. I can announce for tomorrow we'll be starting at 8 a.m., and on the following day, which is Thursday, we will be starting at 8 a.m. So for everyone on the committee, next two mornings, 8 a.m. And if there's not anything else, and I've covered and crossed the T's, dotted the I's, we're adjourned.